This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm David Brancaccio. Now, you've seen the help wanted signs nearly everywhere, and that includes at restaurants. An economist will tell you that labor shortage is only one way to look at it, versus the pay isn't high enough to attract workers at a time of high demand. Well, a noted New York chef is questioning the whole pay low wages, work long hours business model of many restaurants. Peter Hoffman, who co-owned Savoy, a former farm-to-table eatery in New York City, has a new book out called What's Good, a Memoir in 14 Ingredients. He told me too often the restaurant business is built on exploitation.
You know, it's not just about raising wages, although that's an important part, but it's about a workplace that offers work-life balance instead of being forced to work 60, 70 hours a week. And so we have to figure out how to make that possible. You know, one of the implications of it, David, is that dinner's going to cost more. And, you know, there's a lot of pushback. Obviously, we have limited budgets. But my experience being a farm-to-table chef and my journey to educate my customers over decades of running Savoy was that when we showed them what the real cost of food was, that is, if you don't externalize costs and push them onto future generations or push them onto taxpayers because they're paying for healthcare from diet-related diseases, people embrace that and want to pay more for dinner. They want to participate in a better world and a better planet.
So one of two things happens. If you have an enlightened restaurateur who wants to give flexibility, make sure that the work is not as grueling as it typically used to be, and to pay more, prices would go up. You want the patron to actually be willing to pay the extra. And in some cases, the patrons may not be as enlightened as you want them to be. And that could be a moment of reckoning for a certain kind of restaurant.
There may be fallout from all of that. And, you know, when I grew up, dining out was a special occasion. It wasn't something that people did every day of the week in their lives. And we've gotten to the place, and part of that has to do with lowering the cost, that people could not cook at home at all and live their entire lives in restaurants. And so right. I'm not sure that's been healthy for the economy. And that's part of the reckoning that we're seeing now. So when we completely outsource our dietary needs, we're very dependent. And of course, you know, there's a huge proliferation of restaurants that has come with it.
The fancy restaurants are going to do fine, right? And I assume publicly held restaurant chains like Chipotle are, you know, probably going to do all right. But you're worried about a distinctive place that's in the middle?
Yeah. And we see it in so many other parts of the economy and movement in our culture is that the high end will retain and possibly expand, but they're immune to these changes. And then the middle is dropping out, the middle class is dropping out. And so that in this case, what you have are more and more of faster food, fast casual, even if they are about better for you or better for the planet kinds of concepts, which is good. It's sort of farm to table trickle down. But at the end of the day, the restaurant that Susan, my wife, and I built and started, which was a more artistic, individual artistic expression of a exploration of cuisine, those places are going to be harder and harder to maintain and to be profitable.
You're not predicting they can't survive, but the big open question is, if you pay people more, and if you give them more flexibility, which potential restaurant employees will be increasingly demanding after pandemic, the question is, will the diners pay for the difference? That's the question.
Yeah. Will they appreciate the fact that that's an important aspect, or will we come to acclimate that that is what the cost is? Plenty of businesses, right? Large companies have all kinds of perks that they offer their employees that's built in. Everybody understands that healthcare plans are part of large company offerings. Not that they haven't come under pressure. when contracts get reevaluated and things like that over the years because of the high cost of healthcare. But still, they're part of what the company model is. It's not part of the restaurant company model for the most part. And so we trade on, as diners, we want cheap meals instead of saying we want a quality experience and this is what the real cost of dinner is.
And from the potential restaurant employees' point of view, there is a what is seen as a shortage of workers in many parts of the economy. And it might be that the person who says, I don't know if I want to do those hours for that pay at the restaurant when I can get a job working from home for an insurance company that has better benefits.
Precisely. And given the fact that we're still struggling with the pandemic, by definition, it's not a safe workplace, right? Or not as safe as some others. Restaurants don't have the opportunity to work from home. Kitchens are, by design, particularly in urban areas, kitchens are tight and people are working closely together and they're interacting with all kinds of strangers in close quarters without any knowledge of their behaviors. And so people are reluctant to go back into restaurants. I get it. And as we said, it's grueling work. It's not always a positive work environment to be in. It's a business that is being forced, and it's the reckoning is a good reckoning. I love the restaurant business. I loved being in it, and I want it to be a healthy work environment rather than one that burns people out and casts them aside.
So maybe we should brace ourselves for one of our favorite restaurants down the street that, you know, wasn't a chain place, but wasn't a one-star fancy place. You know, you wonder how long they'll be able to stick around.
Yeah, or brace yourself for the fact that you want them to stick around, and so you're prepared to pay more for dinner.
Let's turn to a separate topic, specialized food. When people want what used to be rare and hard to find or only available in a certain season for a certain moment in a year, you know, what do you want from people? If it's good enough for you as a chef, it should be good enough for me. But that has consequences, and you've thought about those consequences.
Yeah. There are multiple chapters in my book where I tell the story of our journey in wanting to produce ubiquity in the food supply and the dangers of that. One of them is the chapter about strawberries. They're highly perishable and very seasonal. So the journey for hundreds of years, actually, but really in the late 20th century, did it get quite serious, was to say, how can we turn this food into a year-round fruit so that it can be available all the time across the nation? What's sad about it is that what we traded away was flavor in order to have increase shelf life so that trucking times across the country could increase and things like that. That's what the title of my book is about. And Sandra's saying, well, what's good? What's good is to say that something is here now and is going to pass and it's transitory. And I love it when it comes into season. And I actually love saying goodbye to it because it reminds us of the ephemeral nature of life, as opposed to trying to think that we're masters of the universe and can have anything that we want any time of the year.
It's amazing the degree to which we've lost this idea of seasons when it comes to food. This weekend, I went to three places, probably burned some gasoline doing so, looking for a pomegranate for this rice salad I wanted to do. Then I got home and was reminded that the reason I couldn't find a pomegranate is it's out of season. And I never even began to consider when is the best time to get a pomegranate. That's the sort of thinking you argue in that book needs to change.
That's right. And that it's not just this self-indulgent, I want to, you know, live this artistic life of living by the seasons. But I'm here in New York City, and in fact, living by the seasons has real implications for our entire society. It's a healthy way to live.
But also your argument extends to bespoke artisanal things that we've come to expect will just be everywhere. That's even more than a seasonal issue.
Yeah. Dr. Seuss in The Lorax talked about biggering and the danger of ever wanting to bigger and bigger. And I think that that's some of what we're looking at, and looking at the climate crisis, climate collapse. So much of that is about wanting more all the time, biggering, as it were, and instead of saying, what grows here, what grows in my region, I'm going to try and live off of, which is not to say that I'm anti-global. I mean, I drink coffee and like lemons and olive oil and things like that. They don't grow in this region. But if I was more limited in those choices, maybe that is a way of living more within our means, as opposed to living so far beyond our means that we are really in the process of destroying the planet.
Peter Hoffman, a longtime chef in New York. His book is called What's Good? A Memoir in 14 Ingredients. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David.